Okay, so photodynamic therapy is kind of relevant to Roswell. It has a lot of historical significance, so we'll get into that a little bit. But just in general, what is photoacoustic imaging? Some would still consider it an emerging technology or a treatment paradigm for cancers. But importantly, it is currently FDA-approved treatment for a variety of oncologic and non-oncologic conditions. And as Dr. Block was saying, it was pioneered actually by Thomas Dougherty, who in 1974, he's still here at Roswell today. This is him right down here. And the treatment or photodynamic therapy involves typically the administration of a drug, which we call a photosensitizer, into the body. And over time, this photosensitizer will accumulate into the tumor. And then at some point, you'll use light at a specific wavelength to shine on the tumor, and you'll get a reaction which allows for the treatment of that tumor. And actually, Thomas Dougherty's, his discovery of it was kind of an accident. So he was doing some vital staining on cells, and what he realized is that when the cells were exposed to light, they died. So that kind of piqued his interest, and that's how he got into PDT. But actually, the history of PDT dates back to the early 1900s. So Oscar Raab was actually a graduate student in the lab of Professor Hermann von Tepinier. And what he observed is that when paramecia were exposed to this acridine orange, this dye, that they actually died from that. And then Professor Hermann von Tepinier, he actually did some studies in humans using eosin, which is a dye that he put onto these patients with lesions on the nose, as you can see here. And afterwards, you could see that didn't completely cure it, but there was definitely an improvement. And this actually highlights one of the benefits of using photodynamic therapy, because even though it can treat the tumor, it actually leaves a lot of connective tissue intact, and therefore you get these very nice cosmetic outcomes. So you can still see the nose, and it doesn't really leave any scars. And in the basic sense, photodynamic therapy has several steps. As I kind of mentioned before, the first is the administration of the photosensitizer into the patient. Usually, over time, you allow this photosensitizer to circulate through the body. And because of some of the unique aspects of the tumor vasculature and also tumor biology, you get preferential accumulation of this drug into the tumor, which you can see here. And then, because of that, you can treat the tumor, and hopefully, most of the other drug has been cleared from the body. Therefore, you can get response more directly in the tumor itself. So this is just a more kind of zoomed-in schematic. If you have this tumor here, you inject your photosensitizer as it accumulates, and then over time you'll have this tumor start to go away, and eventually you'll have full healing of the normal tissue, and you'll have no tumor. And most of this, the action of this, the drug, the way that photodynamic therapy works, is mediated through three effects. The first is a direct cytotoxic effect from the activation of the photosensitizer. The second is disruption of the vasculature in the tumor, and the third is more of immune-mediated response. So you have multiple things going on, which all contribute to this response to photodynamic therapy. And the three most basic components, I should say, essential components for photodynamic therapy, are the sensitizer, the photosensitizer. Obviously, light, and obviously another thing, oxygenation, which I'll get into a little bit later. But these three things typically they're referred to as the photodynamic triad. And the idea is that you really need all three things in order to achieve the lethal effects of PDT. And another important thing to point out is that two of these things actually we can control. So we can control the sensitizer that is used for the treatment, and we can also control the light that's delivered to the tumor. However, one thing which you really can control, which is the photobiology, are things like the oxygenation of the tumor, either if it's the distribution of the photosensitizer, the perfusion of that tumor, and then the rate of diffusion as well. So most of a lot of work obviously is focused on developing these methods to improve response, but then there's also this aspect which there is additional research looking at how we can actually like improve oxygenation or make the tumor more susceptible to PDT. So now I'm going to go through kind of the basic components of the photodynamic triad, starting with the photophysics. And of course, one of the major components is the light source. We need light in order to treat these tumors. And these are typically lasers. This is actually a more a newer model of the lasers. But what this is you have your laser source, if it's either a pump dye laser, a diode laser, or even you can use light, like incandescent light. And essentially connected to this laser are laser fibers. And what you see here on the right, these fibers are all very unique in their own design and shape. And on the next slide, I'll talk a little bit more about that. But the next important thing is that every photosensitizing drug that we use has a very specific way that it absorbs light. So it's also important that we can tune the wavelengths of this laser to treat, to activate the drugs at specific wavelengths. So that's also a critical important characteristics. And in general, we use photodynamic therapy in the range of around 600 to 800 nanometers, but 800 nanometers is preferred because the longer the wavelength, the deeper the light actually can penetrate into the tissue. And again, these light sources can either be pump dye lasers, which are, they have, one of the problems is that they're bulky and inefficient, so more recently these diode lasers are more preferred because they're compact, portable, and cost effective. So as I said, there are unique fibers, several different unique fibers which you can use to perform PDT. And one thing I want to point out is that you can see, you can appreciate that each fiber has a very unique pattern of how it actually illuminates. So they all illuminate the tissue, but it's all done in certain ways. So for instance, if you look at this lens fiber, you kind of have this point source here. This is good if you want to treat maybe more superficial masses and you just want to focus on a certain area. We have these interstitial fibers, which you can actually insert into the tissues, and they kind of give like a dome effect. We have spherical fibers and cylindrical fibers, which might be more used for like endobronchial treatments. They can give it like 360 illumination for multiple regions. And again, no single light source is going to be ideal for all PDT applications or even the same photosensitizer. It's really all dependent on the case, the patient, and what treatments you need to do for the patient. So as I said on a couple of slides ago, another important component is the light, the wavelength of light that's used. So typically, light is given on the range of 600 to 800 nanometers. As you can see, this is blue light is more on the closer to the spectrum of 600 versus red is deeper, closer to 800. So we really prefer to give light in this kind of longer wavelength range because you can get penetration up to even a centimeter in depth. And this is just a way to kind of illustrate that more, like if you're using blue light around 514 nanometers versus if you use red light around 720 nanometers, you can see in this patient's arm just how deep the light actually penetrates. So that's really important, especially if you don't know how deep the tumor is or you're trying to target deeply inside the tumor, not just superficially. Another important thing to consider is that when you're giving light, we need a way that we can actually control the dose that we're giving to these patients and the tumor itself. So light dosimetry is very important because we need to figure out the exact dose of light delivered to the tumor. And therefore, typically we talk about fluence and fluence rate when we refer to dosimetry. So fluence is the total amount of light that is delivered to the tumor, and the fluence rate is essentially how fast that we're delivering that. And that's typically in the order of milliwatts per centimeter squared. And the entire purpose of this is delivering light is to generate sigma oxygen, which results in the primary cytotoxic effects of PDT. And again, this is very dependent on the photosensitizer that's used, because each photosensitizer will have its own rate at specific wavelengths and at different fluence rates. So it's all going to be very tailored to exactly what the application is going to be. And therefore, you really don't want to be under-treating, so you don't want to give too low a fluence rate because you don't want to under-treat, but you also don't want to be giving too high of a fluence rate because you don't want to over-treat and cause damage to normal structures next to the tissue. This is a classic diagram which kind of explains how PDT works. We call it a modified Jablonski diagram. And essentially, normally when you excite something with light, let's say it's a photosensitizer or a fluorochrome, there are electrons in the outer shell of those of the sensitizer, which when exposed to light, will actually become excited. They'll go from the ground state to an excited state. And there are two paths. Either it can decay back to the ground state through fluorescence, where it gives off light at a longer wavelength, or also in addition to heat. Or it can go through something called inter-system crossing, which is really important for PDT, where it can go through two different reactions. The first is a type 1 reaction where this excited electron can actually react with other molecules to donate its electron or hydrogen to that molecule, and usually generates free radicals. However, the type 2 reaction, which is the more common reaction, is where triplet oxygen, either in the blood or tissue, will react with the excited electron to generate singlet oxygen, which is very unstable and therefore has very reactive effects with the tissues and causes that cytotoxic effect, the damaging effect. So there's this dynamic action between the light interacting with the photosensitizer and also the presence of oxygen, which is very important because you need both the sensitizer being activated and also oxygen present to get this type 2 reaction in order to cause damage to the tumor. So when we talk about photosensitizers, we have this ideal design for photosensitizers. So of course we want them to be toxic. They need to be activated easily. As reaction with oxygen is very important, we want them to have high singlet oxygen yield. We also want to be able to administer them easily. They should be eliminated from the normal tissue and stay in the tumor preferentially. And again, they should also be cost effective. And over the past several years, when Thomas Doherty started, he actually came up with porphyrins, photofrin, which is one that he primarily worked with. So that's one of the main classes of photosensitizers. We also have this chlorophyll platform, which I'll talk about later, and there are also other dyes which you can use as photosensitizers. But there is still increasing interest in developing targeted photosensitizers and improving these photosensitizers so that they're more lethal to the tumor and have reduced effects on normal tissues. So first, I'll talk about porphyrin-based ones. One of the original photosensitizers, which was developed by Thomas Doherty, and that was photofrin. Again, this was this agent itself was very useful because it had high singlet oxygen yield, and it absorbed very strongly in the visible spectrum, around 630 nanometers. This is just the structure of photofrin here on the right. So again, it was first developed in around 1974. Several years of toxicity and efficacy studies and clinical trials led to its FDA approval in 1995. And it's one of the most widely used photosensitizers for multiple conditions. But it's definitely, it's currently approved for endobronchial lung cancers and Barrett's esophagus. But one of the biggest limitations, which is shown here on the right, is that although it works very well to treat tumors, it also has long-lasting effects in circulation. It can actually last up to 6 to 8 weeks, where you can have skin toxicities as a result of accumulation of the photosensitizer in other parts of the body. So this led to the development of other agents such as HPPH, which is a chlorine-based sensitizer developed by Ravinder Pandey, who actually is here at Roswell as well. And compared to photofrin, it had significantly decreased photosensitivity than photofrin. And it's currently being undergoing clinical evaluation in head and neck cancer patients and lung cancer patients. And here at Roswell, it's actually being studied. There's multiple clinical trials open. And this was a study by Dr. Balnier, who's another PI here at Roswell, who also helped do a lot of this early work with these photosensitizers. And in this study, they were looking at the effects of HPPH on skin toxicities, since one of the goals was really to see, compared to photofrin, does it actually improve, reduce these toxicities. So this study had 45 patients, and they had several doses of HPPH. And what they were looking at was how many days between when you gave the photosensitizer and when you actually treated these patients did it make a difference in terms of the toxicity of the agent. So they were looking at 133 joules per centimeter squared of solar spectrum light, SSL. And essentially what they saw is that the longer the time that you went between when you administered the agent and when you treated the patient with light, you had this reduction in the skin response, and this is for almost all doses of HPPH. So it's really important. One of the things to think about is, you know, when we are optimizing these treatments for the patients, little things like tweaking how long you wait between when you give the agent and when you treat are very important things that still need to be optimized currently. So the conclusions from this study, though, is that 90% of the patients or subjects exposed to the SSL 3 days after photochlor had better responses that were less severe than those that had either 1 or 2 day intervals. So, and then just going back to some of the toxicities of photodynamic therapy. So, of course, we see this is a patient that received just the SSL, and then you can see this is right after treatment. But then several weeks later, you can see this edema and erythema, sorry, that results in kind of red flaky skin and also pain in those patients. So there's still a lot of work to optimize these therapies. So now just to discuss what are the biological consequences of photodynamic therapy. So as I stated earlier, there's kind of three main ways. There's the direct cytotoxic effect when you generate singlet oxygen. There's also a vascular component where you damage the vasculature, resulting in tumor cell death. And then you also have this inflammatory response, which can be both acute and adaptive. With everything, as I discussed earlier, this is all very dependent on the photosensitizer you use, your light treatment conditions, and tissue oxygenation, which I'll discuss later on in the lecture. So just to bring up the point again, so there's two factors which we can control, which is the light dose and the photosensitizer, but we also can't control things like oxygen. So that's another thing to think about when you consider the response of these tumors to treatment. But this was a study by Chen et al. In 2006, where they had tumors that were treated these are actually mouse models. They looked at comparing vessels that were treated with light, had sensitizer but no light, or those that had sensitizer and light, to see what was the consequence of treatment of PDT on vascular integrity. And as you can see, when you had no light, essentially there was very little change. However, when you have light and you administer this fluorescent or optical dye, you can see over time that the vessels start to leak out this dye. So there is some and damage to the integrity of these vessels, which ultimately leads to disruption of the vessels, hemorrhaging, and then loss of perfusion, which is kind of the final step. And that's partially how PDT exerts its effect, is by shutting down the vasculature and inducing hypoxia in the tumor. And this is just showing that when you have control, no light, essentially you have no dye leaking into the tumor, but when you have PDT, you have leaks of this dye. So it's indicating to us that PDT, one of the main effects is through vascular damage. And this is just another study that was done here at Roswell by Dr. Srinar's group, who's no longer here. But this is interesting because they looked at how the fluence rate affected perfusion of the tumor during treatment. So it's also important to consider what's going on during the treatment, because you need oxygen delivered to the tumor. You don't want to hit it with such a high fluence rate that you shut down the vasculature, and therefore now you have no oxygen and all your photosensitizer is being consumed by the treatment. So they looked at from 10 to 75 milliwatts, and what they saw is that when you use a very high fluence rate at 75 milliwatts centimeter squared, you have this drop in blood flow in the tumor compared to where if you gave a lower fluence rate at around 10 milliwatts centimeter squared, you actually have somewhat of an increase in flow. So this might be preferred if you want to get replenished that oxygen supply. And this was in the surrounding areas where they had light only and there was very little change. So as you can see, tweaking these factors is very important for optimizing PDT. And again, this just goes back, there's still a lot of work in order to understand how we can optimize photodynamic therapy to treat tumors. So the next major step, or next major response, is the immune inflammatory response. So when you treat with PDT, you have this, you have a lot of oxidative stress because of the release of free radicals. So initially, you have this inflammatory response caused by this, and almost as like a homeostatic mechanism to go to that area that's damaged and stop the spread of the damage to other areas. So initially, you have edema because you have a lot of fluid going into that region to kind of control the damage to the surrounding areas. And then as tumor cells die, they will release tumor antigens, which can be picked up by dendritic cells and result in the formation of an adaptive immunity, which is kind of the second half of PDT. So just going over now how currently where PDT sits in the clinic. So as it's still emerging, there are still multiple sites that it's being tested in, but it's currently approved for head and neck cancers, skin cancers, and intra-abdominal sarcomas. And this is just a list of the approved drugs and their applications. And it does have off-label use for other cancer sites such as brain, bladder, prostate, and breast cancer. So going and comparing to other cancer therapies, PDT has several advantages. Compared to other therapies where if you give chemotherapy systemically or radiation therapy or surgery, the nice advantage of PDT is that since it uses light and light can diffuse only so far in tissues, you can do very specific treatment inside either tumors or areas that have tumors. So it can be controlled very well. Going back to that first slide on the patient, you have this reduced morbidity and disfigurement because it leaves the underlying connective tissue intact. It can be repeated over and over again. It's not precluded by any kind of prior treatment, so you can give it anytime, and it has limited systemic toxicities. And then it can be even used as an adjuvant to treat the resected or the tumor bed, so wherever you resect the tumor from, you can actually treat that area with PDT afterwards to kind of clean up the margins around where the tumor was. So first, probably the broadest application or my most widely used application of PDT right now are for skin conditions. And this typically takes advantage of ALA, which is porphyrin precursor, and it can be applied on as almost like as a cream and then given light. And this patient is a patient that has actinic keratosis on the scalp. This is several weeks after treatment. You can see that applying this cream and then hitting with light, you can clean up that area very nicely and leaving very little scars behind. In lung cancer, it's been used for endobronchial lung cancer, even for advanced disease and for palliative intent. This is just a list of the different agents that have been used for endobronchial obstruction or cancer. And as you can see here, so you have lesions that you can spot. So you can see the lesions, so you can actually use this image, or you can use the camera to guide the placement of your lens fiber next to the lesion, and then you have a nice clean response afterwards, and this can allow for clearing up and improving a patient quality of life, improved and re-expansion of the lung, allowing for a better breath. And finally, head and neck cancers, which is the primary focus of our group. These tumors are very aggressive, so they usually require aggressive surgical intervention. And they can lead to several morbidity issues such as speech, appearance, and function. And PDT can offer a lot of benefit. In this one case, this is a case of a lesion on the tongue. And you can see this lesion on the dorsum of the tongue. After treatment, you can see it becomes very scarred. However, afterwards, you get a nice cleanup of the area and the lesion is gone. So again, this goes back to one of the primary benefits of PDT, that it leaves has very nice cosmetic outcomes without compromising function. And as a result, there's a lot of interest in actually developing PDT and using it in combination with other agents, and this is just kind of show you that all the applications that people are focusing on. So there are limitations to using PDT. So as I said earlier, there are some limitations in terms of the toxicity to normal tissues with this treatment approach. There is some idea about using PDT in combination with other agents to improve therapeutic efficacy, as it's really only a local treatment. It can't treat systemically. And another thing that we're kind of focused on, it's important to develop methods that can detect and monitor efficacy or activity of PDT. So we want to be able to see, is it working or is it not working? So if that patient does need to go with a more aggressive treatment strategy or not. So I'm going to kind of talk about how imaging can be used to improve PDT or guide PDT, as we'll say. So functional imaging, such as magnetic resonance imaging, can be very useful for PDT because, as we know, PDT requires blood and oxygenation from the vessels. So if you're able to map kind of the vascularity of the tumor using an imaging technique, you can kind of help predict whether or not that tumor will respond well, or even changes after treatment. Does that indicate response? And so this was a study that was performed in two different tumor models, looking at prior to PDT and 12 hours post PDT. And what you're seeing here, this is what we call blood volume map, essentially how much blood is getting to the tumor, permeability map, which is how leaky the vessels are, and then they've created an overlay, and this is what we call a 3D MR angiography to look at kind of the vessels leading to the tumor. What you can appreciate is that in this tumor following treatment, you can see this collapse of the vasculature within 12 hours post-PDT, as shown by the blood volume map. Very little change in terms of permeability, but important that you can see that there was shutdown, especially in the center of the tumor. And that was observed for this tumor as well. What was interesting here is you can actually see that there was an increase in permeability in this tumor, so that's also something to consider, how PDT can also affect the permeability of the vessels, which might be important for combination therapies. Another useful imaging technique, referred to as blood oxygenation level dependent MRI or BOLD MRI, can be used to measure tumor oxygenation, and you can do this real time during treatment. This is a study done by Dr. Seshadri before I joined the lab, actually. But he looked at essentially two different dose rates. One was given at 150 milliwatts, and the other one was given at 7 milliwatts. So this treatment took almost 2 hours, actually. This treatment took only 6 minutes. And what you can see is that if you look at BOLD, so you're looking for blue as high oxygen levels and red as low oxygen levels. When you give the high fluence, it actually really didn't change the oxygenation that much. It maybe resulted in a little bit of a decrease early on. But by post-treatment, 24 hours post-treatment, levels have actually climbed up higher than before. Versus when you kind of gave it low and slow at 7 milliwatts, you can see this steady drop in blood oxygenation, which culminates at about 24 hours where you have a significant drop. So using PDT in combination with something like BOLD MRI, we can actually do real-time monitoring of the oxygen levels and use it to help maybe predict response. And finally, just using MRI to actually guide the placement of interstitial fibers. So as I mentioned, there's interstitial PDT, where you actually can insert the fiber into the tumor if depth is so much of a limitation. So what's shown here is you can actually see this black region that this arrow pointing to. This is actually where the fiber was placed. And you can see in tumors that were treated with the fiber only, it had very little change on the intensity, the T2 intensity, as you see here, what we call ADC mapping, which is looking at how free the fluid is. So if you see higher ADC, that's an indication of more cell death. So you can see there's very little change when you just have the fiber only. But when you actually turn on the light, you can see a shift towards this very high red ADC level, which is an indication of compromised cellular integrity and damage to the tumor. So, of course, there is a lot of interest in using imaging as well in the clinic. A lot of this work is used for interstitial PDT, again, because they want to guide the fibers into the tumor. And based on the fiber placement, you can actually try and calculate the dose or perform dosimetry of where the fibers are and how much dose is getting treated throughout the tumor. So just like before, you'd have the photosensitizer administered. Then you'd actually place the fibers into the tumor and use MRI to guide it. As you can see, these two fibers right here. And then you would hit with light and hopefully get a better response through this than versus just using surface illumination, where you might hit the top of the tumor and get no change on the bottom of the tumor. And this is just to show you an image of, you know, what it looks like when you actually implant these fibers into the patient. This is the jaw right here, you can see. So this is a rendered CT scan. You can see the fibers here. And this is just showing you have four fibers placed in there. And then next, just to show you, this is kind of before and after treatment. So you have this tumor in the airway. You can see the three fibers that were placed here. And then 24 hours after treatment, as follow-up scan, you can see reduction in the size of the tumor. And finally, just to talk about some of the next generation strategies for photodynamic therapy. So kind of the continuing theme throughout the talk is that there is a lot of work for optimization still with PDT, even though it's every year there's more and more citations, there's a lot of interest building with PDT, there's still a lot of work to do. One of the first things that's being looked at is alternative light delivery methods. One of them is two-photon PDT, which is essentially instead of kind of giving continued light pulse throughout the whole treatment, you actually use short pulses of light into the tumor, but these pulses are going to be very high energy. So instead of having to have continued light, you just have very high pulses and get better penetration. Another one is to look at modified time intervals. As I mentioned with that one paper from Dr. Balnier, looking at the interval between when you actually give the photosensitizer to when you use the light. There's also something called metronomic PDT, where you are going to give very low doses of the agent, the photosensitizer, and then as you give low doses, you're going to give very low light treatments as well, but you're going to treat for weeks instead of days. Of course, there's a lot of interest in modifying the photosensitizers to enhance drug internalization, whether it's like encoding with some kind of agent which will allow higher uptake into the cells, and that kind of falls in line with nanoformulations as well, where you can create these nanoparticles which have a combination of the drugs, the photosensitizer, a targeting agent, and that'll allow for enhanced delivery. And then you can even incorporate some kind of imaging dye, which will allow you to measure how much the agent is actually getting taken up into the tumor, and that'll help maybe figure out if that patients respond well or not. So just to conclude, it was just a very brief talk, but so PDT works by taking light, and a photosensitizer, administering it into the patient, allowing that to accumulate into the tumor, and then you treat with the light and generates ROS, which essentially allows for cytotoxic effects, and then some of these immune effects, and even a vascular response. And finally, I know Dr. Chaudhry always would like to mention that photodynamic therapy is a multidisciplinary endeavor. It requires the work of scientists, physicists, surgeons, radiologists, and nurses to kind of make it all work. So this is something else to consider, I guess. So, yeah, that's all I got. Questions? Yes?
What is the time between when you get the drug and when the laser is administered?
So, some people, so there's the debate of whether what's better. So, it can be days in the case of the HPPH that we're talking about. So, there's 1 day, 2 day, 3 day intervals. Some people actually argue that it's better to use like 1 hour to 3 hour intervals, that it actually might be better, even though you might have some more toxicity to the normal structures, which is why we give it, then let the patient sit for days, that you might be better to actually just let the drug that's in the tumor right there, just treat it 1 hour after administration.
To get the patient sit home in between that time?
Yeah, so one of the things, especially with the early photosensitizers like Photofrin, patients would have to be in their homes for like 6 to 8 weeks because they had residual skin toxicity. So that's one of the major concerns, and I think HPPH helped solve the issue a little bit because it is cleared a little bit faster, and it still gave suitable responses. But yeah, and there's a lot of different agents that are being evaluated which could be even better than those.
How about insurance coverage?
I don't know that, actually. Yeah. So that's something that maybe Dr. Shashadri would know. I'm not familiar with myself. Obviously, the goal is to develop agents which are very cheap that we can administer that makes it cost effective. And I think probably like HPPH is made here at Roswell. I know it's used in clinical trials. According to the people that make it, I think it's pretty cheap. But yeah, I'm not quite sure. Anyone else?
Is the patient laser is applied?
Is he put out?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's true, yeah. So if you're doing a topical treatment, then the patient probably isn't going to be put out. One of the things that I wanted to mention is, so one of the other side effects with topical administration is a severe pain sometimes. So you almost feel this burning sensation. So up in the 58% of the patients report some form of pain during the procedure. But for other more internal procedures, it's not as big of a problem. But for topical administration, it can be limiting sometimes. So there's talk about whether it's worth using local anesthesia to kind of, in addition to that, to kind of reduce those effects. Yeah.